Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast, and really welcome to the first episode of Hugo's There 2.0. I am rolling out the first cycle of new episodes. Selfishly, I'm starting with a book off the list of titles that I wanted to cover that haven't necessarily won anything. So my guest for this episode is Emmanuel Dubois, and he should be no stranger to listeners to my podcasts, having guested previously on Take Me to Your Reader for Slaughterhouse-Five and on Hugo's There for Blackout and All Clear, in both cases bringing his historian knowledge to bear on both those novels. Well, all three of them, really, because Blackout and All Clear are actually two novels. So, Emmanuel, bienvenue, mon ami.
Merci beaucoup. Bonsoir, Seth.
It's good to see you and good to talk to you. And this was one of those things where when I put the list up there, you were one of the first people to grab one of the titles. And it happens that the book that we're going to be talking about, Planet of the Apes by Pierre Boulle, was originally written in French. So that's very cool.
Yes, it's one of the reasons I picked that book. It's not the only one. I'm not the only French-speaking guy in the world, you know, a couple of them. But it's both an interesting read, and the fact that it's a French book translated in English for you is also going to provide some interesting points.
Yeah, and I feel like it's a kind of a underread classic of science fiction. I think most people know about the movies, but not necessarily the book. And, you know, I'm covering this here, even though previously we did cover it on Take Me to Your Reader in our second episode that we ever did. And it was just, I'll get back to that. In the meantime, though, since you have appeared on any of my podcasts, you have started a podcast of your own. And I think it's a good idea to give a plug here.
Well, thank you. So my podcast is a French history podcast for the American public. It's called Lafayette, We Are Here. So you just type Lafayette, We Are Here in any podcast platform or Google, you'll find it. I have over 20 episodes now. Make it for a bit over a year. And I will cover pretty much any subject from a famous person to an event to a movement, like I did the French Enlightenment, for example, or I did Louis XIV. Recently, I did Charles de Gaulle, French Indochina, subjects like this. And I would recommend you listen to my Napoleon episodes this year with the movie coming up. I did two episodes on Napoleon. And so if you want to get a good idea about his life and what he did. There's a lot of preconceptions about the man that would be wrong. I had the chance to have a big episode with four guests, including two historians, on the legacy of Napoleon Bonaparte, which proves interesting and relevant also in the context of the movie, which looks fantastic. You know, I can see two errors per 10 seconds because, you know, I'm a historian geek, but I don't mind them. You know, they don't prevent you from actually understanding the guy in the story. So go for it. And it looks fantastic. It looks accurate, like for the costumes and stuff. It looks, they did the research. So that's a good point.
Nice.
So that's me.
Yeah. And I really enjoy that you have a variety of episodes from, like you did just a sort of a big history idea of the entire history of France, and then you do zoomed in ones, you know, on the French Revolution, and zoomed in on particular characters as well. It's very cool.
And the next one concerns you guys, Americans, because it's going to be on New France, Nouvelle France.
Okay.
And which covered a big part of what is now the United States. Even if many people don't know about that. So stay tuned, man.
Cool. Yeah. So like I said, one thing that I want to change up the format just a little bit for doing at least some of these episodes, because for ones that I wanted to cover, I want to, you know, say, why did I want to cover this one? And like I mentioned, I have previously talked about this one on Take Me to Your Reader and talked about the movies, and I'm sure we'll talk about the movies some here. I purposely didn't go and re-listen to my Take Me to Your Reader episode. Two reasons. One is it's the second episode we ever did, and it's a little clunky. I also didn't want to repeat myself, or at least be conscious of repeating myself. So I'm sure I probably will say some of the things that I said then, because it's the same brain kind of doing it. But I want to do very brief non-spoiler discussion and just sort of overall thoughts, and then go into spoilers for pretty much the whole thing. So starting off for this one, and Emmanuel, I want to get your idea about this too, about, you know, why you're interested in this book. I'll start with mine. For me, it's just kind of a special book. Because of how much I love the Planet of the Apes franchise of movies. And it's one of those books that prior to kind of moving into the podcast for Take Me to Your Reader, I had no idea that the novel existed. And, you know, my only knowledge was that there were movies and that I loved the movies. And I think I said this on the Take Me to Your Reader episode, but there was a library. I used to take public transportation to work, and there was a tiny little library in one of the light rail stops that had a couple of 100 books. And one day I walked by it. I had a library card, so I just grabbed their notebook that said, you know, everything that they had in there, and that's how I found the book. And so it was something that I read like on my work commute, and just loved it from the very start. And now I've read it 3 or 4 times and still think it's absolutely tremendous. So that's why I wanted to talk about it. And so Emmanuel, what about your history with this title and you know, why you were interested in talking about it?
Yeah, so like most people, I discovered the movies before the book, even though, you know, being French is a bit of a shame, but anyway, because the movies got so big that everybody knows about them. And it's interesting because the movies, if you take all of them, they cover the book, but not single one of them actually covers the book. Like you have the theme in these a bit over everyone. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna do when we talk about the movies a bit more, a little rant about Americanization, but that's fine.
Okay.
You can imagine. But it is interesting, you know, how Americans tend to take some property and make it their own. You have a special way of doing this. Let's put it
this way. Well, even if you look at movies, right, there's a lot of very well-regarded American movies that are actually remakes of, you know, Chinese movies, Hong Kong movies, you know, European movies of all kinds. Well, and you know, Americans typically know about the remake.
Yeah, exactly. Well, top of my head, you know the movie True Lies with Schwarzenegger?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's a French movie.
It's a French movie, yeah. Yep.
Anyway, but yours has bigger explosions. But also this book, La Planète des Singes in French, Planet of the Apes, is very interesting because it's, in one sense, a very classic French, what we call the conte philosophique, a philosophical tale. And that goes all the way back to the French Enlightenment. And to me, that's it's very important in the sense that it's pure French way of doing philosophy through a nice story and a clever story, which is a kind of a tradition, and it appeals to me because of that. Voltaire did that in a movie like Micromega. I don't know if you ever heard of that, Micromegas. Mm-hmm. It's basically the story of an alien coming from from the star of Sirius, and that name should ring a bell because that's the protagonist's son's name. So that's an that comes directly from there. And there is another guy coming from Saturn. And they go on Earth. And when they get there, they examine the French society, criticize it, and they give their own point of view on the French society of the time. So it's a tool for Voltaire to criticize the society without saying, hey, it's not me. It's that guy from Saturn, you know?
Right.
So I won't go to the Bastille this time. it's a way of preventing that. So I find it's in that French tradition of tales. So Boulle does not do it not to be imprisoned, hopefully, but he does it as a way to carry his message. And he actually takes on many themes in a relatively small book, which I find very appealing.
Yeah, and that's stuff where I feel like to the American audience, we might not get some of that subtext. So I'll rely on you for that.
Sure.
One thing that I wanted to ask right off the top is throughout the American translation, the word monkey is used instead of ape. And the first, I think, English translation by Zan Fielding that came out, and I think it's the same version that I read, calls the book Monkey Planet. And so is that a mistake on the translator's part, or is there a different French word for monkey and for ape?
So no, the word singe means both.
Okay.
So the thing is, I've looked at the history of this translation, and apparently the first American translation was called Planet of the Apes, but the first English translation was Monkey Planet.
Gotcha.
So because I guess, you know, I think the British translator did not read the book before translating the title, because when you look into it, there are only what you call in English apes, you know, chimps, gorillas, and orangutan. These are apes. They're not monkeys.
Right.
But in French, we call them all singe, but with context, it's pretty easy to figure out what they are. And sometimes we will call them grand singe, which is like great monkey.
Great apes, yeah.
Great apes, so you know. But as a context, it's pretty easy to figure out. I mean, you know, you're not talking about the bonobo here.
Yeah, exactly. I wonder if in a couple of the movies, they kind of still have someone using the word monkey. And in Escape from the Planet of the Apes in particular, it's considered an insult by Cornelius when one of the Earthmen because they've come into the past on Earth and it's all ridiculous, but I love that movie. But he keeps calling him a monkey and Cornelius flies off the handle and murders him. But the guy deserved it. And then in the unfortunate Tim Burton movie, Mark Wahlberg actually says monkeys instead of apes at some point.
Yes. So. It's really interesting because it does touch on that evolution subject that is very important to the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and when you look at sort of the history of evolution versus creation, right, the Scopes trial, which is this famous trial about the teaching of evolution in public schools, is called the Scopes monkey trial. Hmm. So that's the way it's remembered. So let's go ahead and dive into quick non-spoiler synopsis. And, you know, I do want to say, if you haven't read the book, you've only seen the movies, then you do owe it to yourself to check the book out before we spoil it, because there are, of course, some differences between the movie and the book, and some major ones. It's hard also to, I think everybody already knows a lot of what we would consider spoilers, but there are some of the differences that, like, I enjoy when you can read a book and enjoy it on its own merits because it's different enough from the movie. And this is definitely one of those cases where you'll be like, oh, okay, major plot points in that movie did not occur in this book. And that's
yes,
cool.
And I do think that as a whole, the book is more coherent than most of the movies.
Yes. Yeah, and like you said, if you've seen all of the original ape movies, right, you're not going to find anything from Beneath the Planet of the Apes in this book. But aspects of at least the original movie and the Conquest and Battle for Planet of the Apes movies are very much in there. And then the more recent movies kind of do a little correction on some stuff from the book. And we'll talk about that when we get to it.
Yeah. And the Tim Burton movie does have an ending that is closer to the book also.
It does. Yeah. Even though it doesn't make any sense, at least in the movie.
Yes.
So non-spoiler synopsis, do you want me to take this or do you have something prepared?
I didn't write anything for that, but okay. I could go off the top of my head.
I can do it. It's basically like the back of the back flap or the inside flap of the book. So the novel tells the tale of three human explorers from Earth who set out to visit a planet orbiting the star Betelgeuse, and upon landing discover a world in which great apes are the dominant, intelligent, and civilized species, whereas humans are reduced to being savage animals, nonverbal. And that's as far as you can go with the kind of non-spoiler things that people already know about these books. And I don't really want to go further than that until we get over into spoilers.
Yes. And I would say that the book is published in 1963, which in France is, to put it kindly, a troubled time. Mm. The 60s, I mean, you had your own 60s, but in France was a colonizing power, as you know.
Yes.
And we are in the process at that time of pretty much losing all our colonies, which is not a smooth process. Wars and horror stories, like, you know, have no idea. And of course, men like Pierre Boulle, authors, intellectuals, are sensible to this kind of trauma.
Mm.
So, for example, France had lost Algeria during the war in 1962, just right before. And you have parallels in that story to the situation that France was facing. For example, by what right can a society dominate another? Or does technological superiority give you authority? Racial discrimination. And Boulle intends this, in my opinion, to be a reflection of Earth society. I mean, even the planet's name, Soror, it means sister in Latin.
Right.
So it's pretty obvious that, you know, he wants us to see the parallels in that story. And I also enjoyed the structure of the book, if you will. If we can go like in, well, spoiler, but it's from the first chapter. Actually, the story starts with two characters in a ship. They find a message that we find like a small journal, and they start reading it. And this is the story of the main protagonist. And so it's a tale within a tale. So those two characters are called Jean and Phyllis.
Mm-hmm.
And they read through Ulysse's story, who is the main character. And at the end, they will simply reject it as a simple fantasy, even though it's the truth.
Right. Yes. And we'll get to that in spoilers as well.
Yeah.
That's interesting, though. I hadn't really considered what the cultural backdrop was in France, because it's not something, of course, I barely learned American history in high school. And so knowing what was going on in France in the 60s, I I didn't have any idea. So I'm glad that you brought up stuff like the colonization, Algeria, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it makes sense. And also it's, I think like in science fiction, I mean, American science fiction is 100 times bigger than French science fiction. We don't have as much of a, I mean, we have the tradition, I mean, all the way back to Jules Verne, but it's, or even Voltaire, the micro mega story I told you about is science fiction.
Yeah.
But we don't have the same output as you have, or even the British have. It's just a more important genre in English, is what it is. But in the 60s, there's a spike. Another famous work from that time is called La Nuit des Temps, The End of Times, by an author called René Barjavel. And the premise is not, it is on Earth, but it is, I think, in the near future. But they discover basically two humans in Antarctica, frozen in a ship. And of course, they discover one of them is a woman, an astonishingly beautiful woman, and the main character falls in love for her. So you see some parallels, you know.
Yeah.
And it is the 60s, and it is France, you know. So you have to expect beautiful women in the story and men that don't have that high moral standards when it comes to women.
Yes. So overall thoughts about this. When you said, so I discovered this one in my 30s, probably late 20s, maybe. When did you discover this book, and you know, what kind of overall thoughts on it?
I discovered it probably 10 years ago, but actually read it a couple of years ago for the first time.
Okay.
And I really enjoyed it. I mean, it is as I said, it's a small book, quick read, is well paced, well structured, but it does need, I would say, a couple of readings to get all of it. Even though it's smart, even though it's short, it's very well written. I don't know how well the transition is made, but in French, it's very good writing. Boulle is a very good writer.
Okay.
And it's an enjoyable read. And you kind of feel that he's giving you a lot of content here. Mm. That there is a lot of messages, like every single act of the characters carries two or three meanings. To me, it's really a philosophical tale. You should not take it at face value. Yeah. I know that, for example, when it was released, especially in the Anglophone world, Boulle was accused of being a racist, of promoting, how can I put it, like backwards ideas. And yeah, if you read the book at face value, that's what you would think. But either it's a bad translation or an issue with cultural references, I don't know. But in French, it's very obvious. Boulle is not defending those ideas. He's condemning them.
Yeah, it... And for me too, like I instantly loved the book, and I found it pretty well written. I think there's one clunky chapter, but for the most part, the plotting is very good. I think the translation reads just fine. Like I didn't know it wasn't written in English. I knew it was written by a French author, but then I had to find out later that it was actually written in French. But yeah, very, very enjoyable. This time I actually got the Audible version of it just because I've read it in print a few times, and I thought I would listen to the audiobook. It's only like 5.5 hours, something like that. It's a very, very quick book. And yet, I won't say it's dense, but it reads like a longer novel in that I feel like it's well developed, and you spend a little more time with the characters in the book than you, for instance, would get in a movie. Mm-hmm. And the events take place over a longer time.
Yeah, and it's funny because Pierre Boulle himself talked of this book like a fantasy he had. He wrote it for the fun of it. And I've seen that when he was approached to make a movie, at first, of course, by French producers, remember, that's 1963, 64. And he's like, how are you going to do a movie with my book without it looking ridiculous? It's going to look horrible on the screen. He said, so I don't know how the deal was made with the Americans. I guess they convinced him that they had enough effects to make it look good. And they did. I mean, the first movie looks good, especially from the 60s, you know. And
he won an Oscar for the makeup.
Yes. So. I mean, for the time, when you compare it to what was done before that, it is clearly a leap forward. Keeping with that evolution theme. But I'm sure he had no idea what it would span in the long term.
Yeah. Okay, I say we dive right into spoilers. So if you're the type of person who doesn't want to be spoiled on what's in a book, then this is where you jump off. Otherwise, you know, continue along and then decide if the spoiler, if you regret it, let me know. So like you mentioned, there's the framing narrative, and it's kind of amusing because it's two people, two characters out in a pleasure craft just floating through the solar system. I feel like maybe Boulle didn't know how large space is. It's kind of the J.J. Abrams problem where like it would take you months to get anywhere. But I think 50s and 60s science fiction sometimes did that, where
Even the time it takes them to go from our system to Betelgeuse, it takes in account the time fluctuation. Like you travel at the speed of light, hundreds of years are going to pass back back home. But they travel to me, they seem like they travel too far a distance, given how long they travel. So it's like, it's not very well explained. But as you said, you know, it does give it context. And at some point, you're like, okay, just roll with it. It's don't make the calculation.
You can actually do the math and come up with, if they were able to achieve 99.99999 out to 7 or 8 places of the speed of light, then you get not only the time dilation, but you get length contraction. So the journey is shorter. And I think sense. I did the math on the Take Me to Your Reader episode. So it does actually work out. I don't think it has to still be fun. But the framing narrative, they find the message in a bottle, essentially. And it's fun in the book, but you can see why this was not, and especially when we get to the end and we reveal what is happening there, there's a reason why they threw out the framing narrative, because it would have been difficult to do. I think there's one way that it could have been done and it might have been fun, but I'm not surprised that they threw that out.
Yeah, it's not necessary. It just would complicate a bit the
setting. Yeah, I agree. So I'm going to kind of do a rough plot walkthrough and just, you know, wherever you want to talk about anything, just jump in. Mm-hmm. So the book is set in the year 2500-ish. At least that's when the message of the bottle in the bottle is found. So it could have been there for centuries. Who knows? But you do have the main character, and I will try it. Ulysse Meru.
Almost. Ulysse Almost. Meru.
Ulysse Meru.
Meru.
I'll need more practice on that. And then Professor Antel, or is it Antel? Antel. And then the character I can't remember if we mentioned this. I think we were talking about this before we started recording, about the colleague.
Arthur Levin.
Levin, yes. And I want you to definitely talk about some of the language intricacies there. But they're all setting off on a faster than light trip to the Betelgeuse system to investigate an Earth-like planet. It's kind of a big ask for someone to say, hey, how would you like to come on a trip that can't possibly get you home within hundreds of years of the contemporary time? The movie goes into more, the Taylor character in the original movie has him being a misanthrope. He doesn't mind leaving his generation behind. And I don't think they really establish that in the book, that he's that kind of character. He's a journalist, right? He's curious.
He is. And he's just basically saying, sounds fun, let's go.
Yeah.
Because he talks about it, says the reason why he went was it sounded exciting. I don't have a family, whatever, let's go.
Yeah.
So it doesn't need much more explanation than that.
Yeah. Yeah. So do you want to talk about the names of the characters?
Well, I mean, it's just like the Arthur Levin is just, Levin is yeast, as we mentioned.
Right.
So he's rising to his mass because he's the young physicist and Antel is like the master, the professor.
Yes.
And Meru is a bit on the side, is the journalist that is supposed to tell the story. And during the voyage, he learns about like how the ship works and stuff like that. That's going to come in handy later.
Yeah.
But he is not a scientist. He has some scientific knowledge, and that's going to come in handy after when he is on the Planet of the Apes. But actually, Levin is like a support character. You barely see him. He's basically there to be killed.
Yeah, he's the red shirt.
He's the red shirt, exactly. Yeah. you need it. And even when he does, you're like, it's less painful for Ulysse than when he finds out about what happened to the professor.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, and that is interesting, the bit about, you know, essentially being the same word for yeast or leaven that you would have in English.
Yeah, there's small stuff like that. Like the since we're into spoilers, at some point, Ulysse gets a son, and his son is called Sirius, which is the name of the star from the story of Voltaire, Micromegas, which I mentioned. So a lot of small echoes like that.
Yeah.
And playing with old stories. So it's part of the French cultural background. But it's not major, but it's there.
Yeah, it's there. And it's something that, you know, went right by me just because I thought, okay, well, he's just naming his son after a star. You know, everybody knows about the dog star. But he's not an astronomer. So it would have made more sense if he was a scientist to use that name. But that's interesting, a reference to Voltaire. So they crash land on the planet. They call the planet, like you said, Soror, which is the Latin root for sister, and because it appears to be an Earth-like planet, fortunately. And they discover naked feral humans, including Nova, who they describe as golden and perfect.
Yes. She's an interesting character. She's both problematic and interesting.
Yeah.
Because her main attribute, especially during the first two-thirds of the movie, is being beautiful.
Yes.
There's nothing else. At some point, you kind of get that she might be smarter than most of her fellow humans on that planet. But basically, Ulysse is completely gaga about her. And he keeps repeating it, how beautiful she is, how extraordinary she is. And he's like, how can somebody so beautiful can be so dumb?
Right.
You know, like, it doesn't sound good when I say it like this.
Yes.
But it's I don't know how many times he mentions how gorgeous she is and how she should be smarter. Mm-hmm. But once we go past that, I mean, as I said, it is a book from the 60s. You have to acknowledge that. She's the key to the story. And she symbolizes to me both humanity's downfall and hope for salvation within the same character.
Yeah.
And I mean, she is the first local, if you wish, to acknowledge Ulysses' smile and words as something worth exploring and not just threatening.
Right. She also does murder the chimpanzees.
She does. Because to her, it's a death
threat. It's a threat.
She sees a chimp, so she's like, I have to kill him.
Yeah. That was pretty shocking. I didn't remember that.
I recall the first time I read it. I mean, he just comes in, she kills him, she strangles him, and then she runs away. And the three other guys are just like, what?
Complicated woman, isn't she?
Yes.
Interesting. I do think it's funny that there's all the time spent on the main character thinking, and I'm just probably going to call him Taylor just because it's either easier for me, of him thinking of how, you know, she's beautiful, but very stupid or very unintelligent anyway. And yet there's the time when they're all locked up together and he realizes if he wants to get with her, he has to do the stupid mating dance.
Yes.
And he just is so humiliated to find himself doing it because he's that helpless around her.
On that, that to me is one of the main themes of the book. There is evolution in it. It's going to be talked about a lot in the book by both Ulysse and by the ape scientists.
Right.
Because they're going to discover in the story that maybe the humans were there before, maybe they established a civilization, and for some reason they regressed and the apes took their place. And about that dance, when Ulysse realizes he has to do that and he has to do what the apes expect of him. They don't expect a man to talk or to do anything else. They expect him to be a beast, basically.
Yeah.
I find that Pierre Boulle wrote a super paragraph about it, if you allow me to read it.
Yeah.
I'll read it in French and then in English because it just sounds better in French, like you expect.
As long as you read it, it sounds better in French. If I read it, it would not sound.
But I just find it clever and to the point, so bear with me. Oui, moi, un des rois de la création, je commençais à tourner en rond autour de ma belle. Moi, l'ultime chef-d'œuvre d'une évolution millénaire, devant tous ces singes assemblés qui m'observaient avec avidité, devant un vieil orang-outan qui dictait des notes à sa secrétaire, devant un chimpanzé femelle qui souriait d'un air complaisant, devant deux gorilles ricanant, moi, un homme, invoquant l'excuse de circonstances cosmiques exceptionnelles, bien persuadé en cet instant qu'il existe plus de choses sur les planètes et dans le ciel que n'en a jamais rêvé la philosophie humaine. Moi, Ulysse Mérou, j'entamais à la façon du pan autour de la merveilleuse Nora, Nova, la parade de l'amour. So that's the French version.
Mm-hmm.
And in translation, it means, yes, I, one of the kings of creation, began to pace around my bell. I, the ultimate masterpiece of a millennial evolution, stood before all these assembled apes who observed me eagerly in front of an old orangutan, dictating notes to his secretary, before a female chimpanzee, smiling with complacency, and two snickering gorillas. I, a man, invoking the excuse of exceptional cosmic circumstances, firmly believed at that moment that there are more things on the planets and in the sky that were ever dreamed of in human philosophy. I, Ulysse Mérou, began in the manner of peacocks, the courtship dance of love around the marvelous Nova. So here you have many interesting elements. The fact that he considers himself a prime example of human supremacy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he uses the more man more than human. I mean, in French, it's pretty common at the time that man means human.
Yeah.
I think even in English at that point.
Yeah. And when I grew up, it was the same way.
Yeah. So I don't think he means it that as men only, the human race is the top of evolution. But it takes a big slap in the face at this point mm-hmm. in the book. So it's very interesting that how he sees himself, and he acknowledges that he has to do those things to get what he wants and to survive.
Yeah. I mean, that was jumping ahead a little ways to his captivity, and how we got there was similar to what we have in the movies where a hunting party comes through. And this is where it's revealed that the dominant species are the apes. They capture some of the humans, including Uliz. And unlike the movies, he's not shot in the neck. You know, he's not injured in any way. It's just when they lock him up, he's not able to communicate with them because he doesn't know their language. And that's a big difference. So you never get the damn dirty apes moment, which is too bad, but it's a great moment in the movie. And I like, you know, that kind of novelty in there. One real big difference though, between the movie and the book is that the book goes to great lengths to say that the ape city is a city of technology. It's a modern city, and it's not nearly as primitive as it looked in the movies, where, you know, they're using horse-drawn carriages and that kind of stuff. In this, they have vehicles. But there's also notes about some ape-specific technology. For instance, their crosswalks, they don't have to cross in front of cars. They just climb over, you know, hand over hand on bars above the road. And I thought, well, of course, that's the way they would do it.
Makes perfect sense.
Yeah, yeah. So that was kind of neat.
Yeah, and I like that, as you mentioned, Uliz cannot talk to them because he doesn't speak the language. And when he tries, basically they see him as a trained, what we would see as a trained monkey.
Like right.
He's repeating some stuff that he's learned, but he's not actually intelligent.
Yeah.
And I find very funny and smart that Uliz proves his intelligence through mathematics by showing the Pythagorean theorem and by drawing the system of Betelgeuse. So I find this approach very smart and very typical of, you know, French Enlightenment. It's really part of that philosophy. Mm-hmm. So it's brilliant. It's realistic also, because if we encounter an alien species, math will be the only common denominator.
Yeah.
Or yeah, so
and,
I think.
And even once he starts to gain some knowledge of the ape language, when he, you know, he points at someone and says their name and does a couple of other things, and they just see, oh, that's cute mimicry that he's doing. Yes. Kind of like when we've taught sign language to gorillas. They're not really learning a language. They're learning to do things, you know, almost like a parrot does, or like, you know, my dogs know some certain names. But if you say a name that rhymes with that name, they'll perk up the same way because they don't really know the name. They just know the approximate sound.
Yes. And that's when he meets Zira,
yes.
And the female, she's a chimpanzee. And she, of course, symbolizes science and reason. Mm-hmm. In the story on the apes part, whereas her boss, Zaius, is prejudice and bigotry.
Yeah.
So there is also a big societal comment in how the apes' world is structured. Of course, it's not an exact
yes.
copy of our own, but it does have many echoes to our own society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you have the intellectuals, or at least the scientists, that are the chimpanzees, right? And then you have the police/military that are the gorillas, and then the orangutans, who are more the government and philosophers and religious leaders as well.
Yes,
and
exactly.
That gets pretty twisted in there. And I like that this is the bulk of the book to me, right? There's longer spent here than I had remembered of him trying to win over Zira and for her to realize he was intelligent, but for her to be smart enough to know we can't give away our hand too early because the orangutans won't stand for it. And so they don't let Dr. Zaius in on things until they can do it in such a way as to prove everything that they're trying to do. And this is a major difference in that he reveals himself to a large company of other apes and leaders and that kind of stuff, and becomes emancipated, and so that he can move around basically as a free citizen.
Yes, and you see the precautions that they take are very important to mm-hmm. to Zira, because she understands that if they jump the gun, it will backfire dramatically.
Yeah.
And Uliz understands that pretty quickly, I would say. I mean, he's frustrated, yeah. of course, but you can see he understands that. And maybe I'm reading a bit too much into that, but to me, the historical context of the book is very important, not only in France, but like the world at that time. Because when Zaius, as I mentioned, is her superior and he's the boss of the lab where she works. Mm-hmm. And he, as you said, he thinks that he is copying what he sees, that he doesn't actually have an understanding and intellectual capabilities. It is the same argument that was made in the 60s by Westerners comparing some Asian countries.
Yeah.
Especially Japan, that were on the rise at that time. We thought them incapable of innovation, just capable of aping what the Westerners were doing and to clone it. I recall vividly, even in my childhood, I mean, not that long ago, that we thought it was common saying that the Chinese, for example, were incapable of inventing anything. They were just copying our stuff, which is completely ridiculous if you know anything about China or any people for that matter. I mean, all humans have the same brain. I mean, get a book. And Bull, of course, does not believe that. And he demonstrates how that is wrong and hurtful.
Yeah.
And despite evidence to the contrary, the people in charge and the majority of the population just won't accept that those they deem inferior are capable of achieving that much, even though they are. And that reason is very, sadly, still very true to in this day and age. Many people still have prejudices that are so deep in their body, in their feelings, that they just won't recognize reality for what it is. They will see it as fake news, as you say in the States.
Yeah. And there's something too, where the tendency to see what you expect. And so if you expect humans, for instance, cannot be intelligent, then anything that they do, you will reinterpret through a lens of, well, what could a non-intelligent being do that looks like intelligence?
Yeah. It's, if you look with it through those eyes, you're never going to see the truth. And you can see that Zira and her husband, his name escapes me at the moment.
Cornelius.
Cornelius, thank you. They fight for Ulysse, but before because it's also, they understand that his cause is their cause, is to make their own society go forward. And the chimps in that, or chimpanzee, I don't know if these are synonyms for you.
Yeah.
Chimps and chimpanzees, yeah. They are the creative ones, they are the innovative ones, and they are blocked by the orangutan that are actually in charge. And it's like they're both the church and the state at the same time.
Right, they're the conservative force, right?
Exactly.
The orangutans.
In a very broad way. And it's the way structured, it is very reminiscent of the way the French society was built before the French Revolution. You know, you have the three estates, you know, you have the gorillas that are the nobility, basically the warrior caste. You have the orangutan that are the church and the state. And you have the third estate, everybody else. These are the chimps. These are the clever ones, the ones actually doing the work. Mm-hmm. So there is a lot of things here that remind me of French history. Of course, Pierre Boulle being a French author, it makes perfect sense. But it can be applied to many societies, not just the French one, of course.
Right. And Cornelius and Zira realize that as long as they stay in their lane, they're okay. But if they do anything that smacks of revolution in any way, or anything that varies from the kind of accepted, this is the way things are, that's where they get into trouble.
Yes, exactly. And they fear that. You can see that they fear that very dearly. And you can see where it would go, because Bull gives us an example with Professor Antel.
Right.
What happens to him is exactly what would have happened to Ulysse if they had not listened to him. And it's quite scary, actually. I mean, the man is an intellectual. He's a scientist. Ulysse loves the man. I mean, he has huge respect for him.
Yes.
And at some point, I mean, I'm jumping a bit ahead, but it's part of that theme. At some point, he wants to free him, and he finds him in a zoo, and he goes talk to him, but there's nobody there anymore. They completely broke him. He is not that professor anymore. He's just part of that human, bestial society that doesn't even know how to talk anymore.
Yeah.
So it is reminiscent of stories like, you know, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest or stuff like that, that is a critic of both human imprisonment and the mistreatment of animals kind of at the same time.
Yeah.
And that it can lead to terrible consequences for the subjects and destroy the moral fiber of the society.
Yeah, I wasn't totally sure about the professor and how essentially he reverts to being savage, right? He loses the capacity to use language, and I wasn't certain that, you know, in the movie that character is it's a different character, but he's lobotomized, right? And so he's he got that way through medicine, right? Through, well, medicine, quote, medicine, butchery. Where here, I didn't necessarily get the impression that he had been tortured or forced into that situation, but he allowed himself to just go feral.
Yeah, exactly. It's not a medical procedure. It's just, you know, the fact that they put him in that situation, he went into survival mode, basically, you know, and he had to do this to survive. Just like Ulysse had to do his own thing in a completely different context. And Antel adapted in the way he could. So again, the theme of evolution, of adaptation, all that stuff carries on. Mm-hmm. So it's always part of the book that basically we would do anything to survive. And sometimes that means transforming into beasts.
Yeah. I wasn't totally sure that I bought that would happen, but...
It's a bit fast.
In a book with apes rising to intelligence and being verbal and all that kind of stuff, I can accept it.
You have to suspend this belief at some point.
Yeah. So Cornelius is an archaeologist, and he reveals to the main character that there's an ancient human city that's been dug up. And this is something that's common between the book and the movie. And in the movie, it's more of a reveal. But I really like the – and I can't remember. Maybe you can help me with this. I can't remember if Cornelius puts forth this theory that he fears that the apes may be only capable of mimicry. And so they may not be able to – may not have the capacity for the original thought, kind of like we were talking about the racist ideas about other cultures here.
He does talk about it to Ulysse, and they both have like an exchange about that. And Ulysse, you can hear in his head his reflection that he understands that the ape society evolves very slowly because they're basically just doing the same thing over and over again. Yeah. So what the humans would do, like, I don't know, 500 years, it would take them 5,000 years because especially the orangutan and the gorillas are basically incapable of innovating anything. They're just go over and over doing this.
Well, and they don't want to innovate anything, right? Because like exactly. I said, the orangutans are the conservative force and the gorillas are the muscle that helps them enforce it.
Exactly. So they just don't want it and they can see past that. But you can see that scientists like Cornelius have that theory that this is a problem within their own species. Mm-hmm. And it makes sense to Ulysse, and especially the more they talk with him, the more it makes sense to them that they have this issue.
Yeah.
But of course, when they find that a human doll in the site, and they see it talks, and it was made by humans who spoke, and they made the doll in their image. Reminds me of a book, Making Somebody in Your Image.
Yes.
And I think it's famous. Anyway, and they see that, and he says, even though to me it's perfect proof that some humans made that, the orangutan is just going to say, we made that to play with humans and we made it so it looks like us. You know, they're just always going to reject everything. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's also an important theme that for some reason I find more relevant today than it was even in the 60s. And that's the theme of intellectual abdication. Mm. Pierre Boulle talks about that in all over the book, but especially in that that part about the finds, the archaeological finds, that if we forfeit our intelligence and reason, we cannot be complained about the consequences. I mean, if we are replaced by others who are more daring and we cave in, when can we say about it?
Yeah.
I find this, as I said, very relevant today. I mean, bullying seems to gain legitimacy over the last few years and trump reason with sheer force and determination. It is very dangerous and it can lead to disastrous consequences.
Yeah.
And as a species, we are experiencing what I think is the beginning of a transformative and potentially fatal era. So if we let the bullies, the authoritarians, the gorillas, and the orangutan of our society dictate the terms of our survival, we might not have one. Mm-hmm. And worse, I think we would deserve our fate in that case.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And there's another side to that too, that it's easy for, you see Americans doing this where they're suspicious of other countries that are out innovating the United States sometimes in some areas, right? And so then they're like, well, no, you got to buy American, and wanting to become very insular and very nationalistic and reject anything that comes from the outside. Even though, of course, you know, these other nations might be just doing it through hard work, right? It's not, they're not doing anything shady. Necessarily, not saying that there's no shading dealings going on, but rejecting things as a knee jerk, you know, not a good look.
No, if I could give you like a small historical equivalence,
yeah,
I talk about this on my own podcast about the Vietnam War, talking about your one of your favorite presidents, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, who hated the French. Like, he had it in his bones. He hated the French. He had many prejudices against them, and his whole administration did, because he brought those guys over, of course. And that was a big issue, because the French were the ones who had colonized the place, Indochina.
Right.
So they had some experience over the last 100 years or so about this country. And the French got out of it in 54. Americans come in more and more and more and more. You know, it's a rising involvement. And the French in like 1960, 61, 62 are basically saying to the Americans, you know, we could help you settle something without a war. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't want a war in that area of the world. It's going to be horrible. They told them about that over and over. And the Americans, they didn't look at the message. They were looking at who was giving the message.
Yeah.
And because it was coming from the French, they were like, nah, we're not going to listen to that. And in retrospect, when you read those letters, when you read those exchanges, the historian that I talk about, Jeff McLaughlin, did a whole book about this. And he explains it way better than I'm doing now in the podcast episode we did. It's so frustrating. Like, you're getting the notes from people in the know who've been there for like a century. Here's the problem. And you're saying, I won't listen to you because you are you.
Right. I don't trust the messenger. Yeah.
I don't trust the messenger. Mm-hmm. I mean, the reason was France had lost World War II. They're not a big power anymore. They had many people corrupted with the Nazis and stuff. I'm like, what does this have to do with what's going on in Indochina, in Vietnam, Laos, in Cambodia? It has nothing to do with it. But it was a reasoning.
Yeah.
And as you perfectly well know, Vietnam was not exactly a pleasant experience for the U.S. in the end.
No, not good at all. So I want to talk about the clunky chapter. And the clunky chapter to me is the one where, you know, Zira is doing work on the brains of humans and has discovered that when you stimulate this particular area of the brain, it gets the person talking. Now, this has foundation in actual medical science. There are ways that you can stimulate the brain and someone will start talking, even someone who has speech issues. But the content of the speech is more or less racial memory, where like every human has this memory of how the apes took over. And the story is quite familiar to anyone who's watched the movie series, because it starts with apes being taken on as pets / servants / slaves. And then eventually the apes taking over. And the idea that the apes always had the anatomy to speak, just not the will to, that doesn't work. I was reading about this yesterday, doing a little Wikipedia kind of research, trying to find out, could apes speak? And, you know, lots of apes and monkeys have, you know, larynxes, they can make noises, but the idea that the apes would be able to speak with no anatomical or evolutionary change, that doesn't really work for me. Communicate, I can accept. But that's the chapter of the book that, from a science fiction perspective, reads as 10, 20 years earlier than 1963 to me.
Yeah, I see what you mean. It does not make much sense. I mean, I think the important, he wanted a way to tell the story of what happened in a clear way. And that's what he found, which is, I agree, not as good as the rest of the book, let's put it this way. Because the rest of the book is very well balanced, very believable. And that is like, this is a bit clunky.
Yeah.
It's also important, though, because it does carry the message about torture for medical reasons.
Yes. And, yeah, vivisection and all kinds of stuff. Yeah.
Exactly. And as I said, you know, you're 17 years away from World War II, so at this point. So it is pretty fresh memory for them. And it is an important theme. And I think he wants to, you know, repeat that. Not a good thing to do such things.
And my biggest problem with it is I feel like it's one of those things where like beta readers read the book and said, I don't quite understand how the apes took over. And he went back and added that. And because I don't feel like it's necessary. You already had the archaeological dig that showed there was an earlier human civilization. And so, you know, the apes took over. I don't think we needed the explanation of how it works. And that's always the complicated thing with science fiction, is the more you go to explaining it, the easier it is for it to become extremely dated.
Yeah. Hopefully the people producing the new Star Wars stuff will listen to us.
Yeah.
It's completely unnecessary. But yeah, I agree with you. It's a big exposition, like you see in so many movies that, you know, it's true. It's like if you trust the intelligence of your audience a bit more, you know, they're going to understand the the themes and the basis, and they're going to go with it.
Yeah.
But also maybe as you said, maybe he had some people read it and they say, I don't understand how this came to happen. So this came to be. So he put this to just.
Yeah. And it's one of those things too, where that's your problem with they go to a different planet and they discover that there's not only apes, but humans on a different planet. And that's your question, because it's a very Star Trek thing, right? Where you've gone from one planet with humans on it to another planet with humans on it. And it doesn't even strike you as strange that you have exactly the same morphological things. They didn't even have, you know, novel forehead architecture like they did in Star Trek.
True. Exactly. At least they had prosthetics in Star Trek.
Yes. One thing that we didn't mention was that at some point Nova becomes pregnant by Uliz. And that is a major plot point because Cornelius and Zira realize this baby is a threat to ape society. And especially once the baby is born and begins, you know, precociously talking or making pre-speech sounds much earlier even than I think a typical human baby would. You've had a baby more recently than I have, but I don't remember Ethan making pre-talking sounds at 3 months.
Yelling, yes. But
yes.
making pre-talking sounds, no. So it's, of course, they have a genius. I mean, why not?
Yeah.
I guess you have to move the plot forward.
Yes.
But it's, but I mean, even without that, it would be believable that there are differences between his baby and the typical human baby in that society, given the fact that they have absolutely no... He says it many times. He sees it in their eyes. There is no intelligence behind
it.
It's like looking at a beast. So, of course, if the baby has that intelligence, it's gonna show very... I would believe that you could see that at 3 months. I mean, when you look at a human baby at 3 months old, you can see there is intelligence in that being.
Yeah.
He cannot talk. He cannot do all that stuff. But you can see he's a smart being.
Yeah. Well, and that's why, you know, with children, right, you can teach them sign language before they're verbal and they can learn it. I think it's interesting that Escape from the Planet of the Apes almost kind of picks up a little bit of that because Cornelius and Zira have a baby on Earth and you have the same thing where this baby is now a threat. This family is a threat because they're telling about another Earth where the apes are the dominant species. And so the humans are suspicious, and that ends in tragic ways, but it leads to the rest of the series, which is fun.
Yes. And if we go into the last part of the book, because they have that baby, so the Zira and Cornelius figure out that you have to get out of here. You have to leave the planet. And of course, they have a way of getting him off world. I mean, off planet. And then they still have their ship orbiting the planet.
Right.
And it is very easy for them, I find, to make a connection in orbit, you know, especially that these two ships were not designed by the same species, but anyhow.
Yes, docking is universal.
Docking, you know, ask any Apollo pilot how easy it is to dock.
They just did a very orbit. Quick spacewalk between the
exactly.
vessels. Yeah.
So it's like, okay, you know, same thing. It's a bit wrong with it. And because it works for the plot.
Yeah.
And same, as you said, you know, if that's your problem, you know, you're stuck on details. At this
point. Yeah, yeah.
So they get back on the ship. They head back to Earth. During the travel, the baby starts speaking and stuff over the few months, because basically that's realistic. He explains that they accelerate for a very long time.
Yeah.
They are at light speed for a very short time and they decelerate for a very long time. That's actually accurate, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So because the acceleration, you cannot accelerate any faster, otherwise you would transform yourself into goo. You know, you would die.
Yeah.
So that's actually thought about. You know, you can see Bull did some research on how this stuff works, which is not common knowledge in 1963. I mean, even today it's not common knowledge. The average person doesn't know about that. Yeah, nor do I think so. But anyway, and what I find funny is that the end of the book, if we can talk about it here now, he goes back to Earth. He finds it very similar. He heads to France because he's French.
Right.
So he heads back to France, lands in Paris at the Orly airport, gets out there, and he's greeted by apes.
Right.
So that's very similar to the Tim Burton movie, where he goes back to what he thinks is Earth anyway. But in that case, it's Washington, D.C. And same things, he's greeted by apes.
Yeah.
And I'm going to do a small rant, if you allow me.
Yeah, please.
Look, I have nothing against American culture. But when you grab a story from another culture, you don't have to Americanize the shit out of it. I mean, I get that you want the character to be believable. You want the audience to relate to that character.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing, not only Americans watch American movies, and I don't think having a ship landing in Paris, France, would not be recognized as Paris, France. You know,
right?
Who doesn't know Paris?
Yes.
It's like you don't need that to be Washington D.C.
Yes. So that's establishing an shot of the Eiffel Tower, and you're good. Right.
Exactly, yeah. And it's not like it's an ugly city to look at anyway.
Right.
And so it's the kind of stuff that just like why? There is no reason. It's like whitewashing, but this is cultural washing.
Yes.
And sometimes it's in small details. Talking about non-French stuff, are you familiar with the movie Castle in the Sky? It's
familiar,
a Japanese movie. It's an anime movie.
Okay, then no. I'm not a fan of anime.
Fine, but it's a beautiful movie from 1988, I think.
Mm.
And that movie has a tremendous score. Absolutely beautiful score.
Mm.
It is the same score everywhere on Earth, except in America. Because the producers felt that it was too Japanese or too non-American. So they asked the composer to remake the score to be more palatable to your ears.
Hmm.
Talk about not trusting your audience, asking the guy to change the score. So the score in the American, I mean, look at it on Netflix, look at Castle in the Sky, look at the movie like in Japanese with subtitle and look at it again in English.
Hmm.
You're going to have the two scores. And of course, the American score sucks in the sense that it's very bland compared to the original one. It's the same theme, the same harmony, but it's not the same music.
It's dumbed down, right?
It's dumbed down. And you're like, why? I mean, if an American is watching a Japanese movie, he's going to expect it to be different.
Yeah.
Why would he expect it to be American? So that's something that, I mean, these guys have no spine. I mean, the American producers and, I don't know, importers or people that have the rights for America, these guys have no spines and they don't believe that their audience have a brain.
Yeah.
Even though they do. I mean, Americans are not dumber than anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody from Hollywood listens to me today, just trust your audience. Carry on these cultural differences. They are variable. They are actually something good to watch. You know, each time I talk about my podcast, French History to Americans, that's why I did it.
You know,
people are interested in that stuff. Not because it's only France, because it is something else outside of their own little world. And people want to learn about that. Why do we read science fiction in the first place? You know, not just to talk about our own home. So it is important to acknowledge that, I think.
No, it's an excellent rant. I agree wholeheartedly. It is interesting, though, when he's sort of on his final approach, that he notices that he's surprised. It's been 400 years since he left, essentially.
And
it looks the same. And that's it's a great sort of first thing that you can pick up on and go, oh, I think I know what force might keep it from advancing if the apes took over and we're just mimicking it. And it makes absolute perfect sense in this novel. It makes absolutely no sense in the Burton movie. And I liked it just because for somebody who had read the book, I was like, I understood that reference, you know, but nonsensical.
Yeah, that movie is weird, especially given it's Tim Burton, who usually makes very good movies.
Yeah.
This one is like a miss. I don't know what happened. Mm-hmm. I have no knowledge of the history of the production or writing of that movie, but something went wrong.
Yeah. I will say the production values in terms of the ape makeup is tremendous.
It is.
And it's leaps and bounds better than the 68 movie. But I think I feel like the producers realized the ape makeup only needs to be good enough to get the audience to buy in. And to me, it was good enough for that. I watched it with Ethan at some point, and he was like, I have a hard time getting past the makeup. But, you know, this was somebody who grew up watching the reboot series, right, with motion capture and all that kind of stuff, which would have been a different thing.
Yes. So it's not aged well.
But I can still watch him and enjoy him.
Yeah, and you know, I like Paul Giamatti as an orangutan. It's just fun to watch.
Yes.
He's a good actor, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, the actors are mostly good in that movie. It's like, you have all the elements to make a good movie, and it ends up not being a good one, mostly because of the writing.
Yeah.
More than anything else.
So at this point, we have them, I think they get right back on their ship and bug out again. I don't know what their plans are.
Well, he does tell that this ship, he says it, I think, at the beginning of the book, that the ship is able to sustain life for a very long time. Like, they have reserves and they have the ability to grow food and water and all that stuff. So he goes into small explanations on how that works. I mean, this is Pierre Boulle, it's not, you know, Victor Vinci or something like that.
Right.
But still you get the sense that they could live their whole lives on that ship and be fine. I don't know how fine that'd be. I mean, I've read the Ender Saga.
Right.
So you know how well you turn out when you grow up on a ship. I mean, the Bean Saga.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for those of your listeners, many of them probably have read that saga too.
Right, right.
So it's not really told about, but then he does put this message in space, and it is found out by the two characters from the beginning of the book who turned out to be apes.
Yes. And they go, oh, that's like, ridiculous.
Exactly.
It's a fun fantasy, but it can't be true.
And then he grabs some tool with his four hands and does something so it's funny. And on that note of funny stuff, there's a few good lines, I would say good humor in the book. And the one scene where I did laugh out loud is the one when Ulysses and Zira are about to kiss. Like, they have love for each other.
Right.
And she rejects him at the last moment, claiming that he is just too ugly.
Yes.
It's like, in French, it's, non, mon chéri. You know, it's so funny in the French. I'm sure it translates well, but I did laugh out loud at that scene because it's very short.
Yeah.
And you can see the affection and like, no, you're just really ugly, but it's the ape talking to the humans and you're too ugly.
And that's in the 68 movie as well. You're just so damned ugly, she says.
Exactly. But I found it in the book I found in the movie it works, but I found in the book it just works a bit better.
Yeah, yeah. My favorite part at the end of the movie is when Taylor shaves off his beard and kind of, you know, looks at Cornelius and is like, hey, what do you think? And Cornelius says, somehow it makes you look less intelligent because he looks less like an ape, right?
Of course.
Because his face makes sense. Bare. Yeah.
Makes sense.
So yeah, that's about the plot. So if there's anything else that you want to talk about, you know, things to discuss, or if you want to talk about the movies a little bit, we can do whatever.
As for the movies, I mean, the prequel they did, the trilogy, it does cover all that evolution stuff and that race supremacy stuff. There is also, I mean, we didn't talk about it much, but the book talks about slavery a lot. It does talk about slavery and emancipation, which resonates everywhere. Mm-hmm. In the movies, I feel that it's there. It's not exploited as much as in the movie. I mean, you do see Charlton Heston with a car around his neck and being carrying around like a slave.
Yeah.
So it is there. It's just not talked about much. It's more a bit more in the book. In the movies, focus more. I mean, they are movies, so they focus more about conflict, of course.
Yeah.
You know, the war and all that leads to that. And there are good movies. I mean, I like those movies. I do think they carry more themes than most action movies do.
Mm-hmm.
I think they are deeper than most action movies are, which is good and rare, you know. So they're still very relevant, I think.
And the movies definitely pick up a lot of the kind of conservative nature of the orangutans and the Minister of Science and Defender of the Faith thing.
Yes.
Where, you know, there's official science, right? That we have nothing to fear from real science. And it reminds me very much of Ken Ham and the Bill Nye debate, where, you know, he's saying, well, there's historical science and there's empirical science. No, there's science, buddy. Just evolution happened. Just because you don't like it doesn't mean it didn't.
The good thing about science is it's still true even if you don't believe it.
Yes. Neil deGrasse Tyson. Yes.
There you go.
And there's a suspicion. I think it may be uniquely American. I don't know. The suspicion of settled science, right? Anytime somebody says, well, we've sorted that answer. We know it. Then we go, oh, are you sure? You know, what about this? I did my own research, you know? Science by its nature is not settled. But the thing that I don't think people understand is that when we talk about changes that are going to be made to a well-established theory, it's little changes, right? It's refining of a model. And so we're not going to find something that overthrows evolution. We'll find things that, for instance, the discovery of DNA and you know, all we've learned about genes have helped refine the model. You know, the origins of the universe, we've refined those models, but we've never just thrown the apple cart, right, and started fresh. The closest we have with that is like the quantum revolution in physics. But even that is still there's work going on trying to harmonize everything. And maybe that will result in an entirely new theory. But sorry, rant about settled science.
That's fine. And to reassure you, or not to reassure you, it's not only in America that we've seen it. So it's pretty much everywhere. I mean, through history, many times over, we've seen that people just not believing something because that's not what I've been taught. Okay, well, the concept of researching, you know, is discovering new stuff. Mm-hmm. Read the definition of the world. So it is what it is. And you just have to go with it if it's plausible. But you can see how the human brain works regarding to new facts and new things. Even if they are in your face, if you were raised in a certain way, or if you were taught in a certain way, you won't believe it. I mean, take flat earthers as examples.
Right.
I mean, there's like a dozen ways can prove the earth is round just by going outside and showing them.
Right. Without any math. Yeah.
Without anything. And they just won't believe it.
Yeah. It's the power of motivated reasoning, right?
It is.
I don't want to believe in this, and therefore I will find reasons to reject it. That's one of the things I saw during the pandemic with the vaccines, was because there were people who didn't want to accept a vaccine because they believed that COVID was being overblown because political things, because their leader was saying that it wasn't a big deal. So they didn't want to accept a vaccine. So they found out, oh, it's an mRNA vaccine that's been developed using fetal stem cell lines. So now I have a reason I can reject it. But it was the motivation behind rejecting it.
Yes. I mean, as everyone I have experienced dealing with these people, I work in a store, you know?
Yeah.
So I did have my share of loonies regarding that. And it's always, you know, it's just a preconception and then you're going to pick up. And what I know, the argument that fits your, what you're saying, and what I noticed, because if I may say so, my own father who passed away last year was one of those people who did not believe in the vaccine. Mm. He did not believe in that. The reasons he found would change every 3 weeks, but they would also always fit his narrative that started from day one, or maybe day 10, you know, at the first couple of weeks were crazy for everybody. Mm-hmm. But I think that's how you react to the unknown. And if you are not well-trained in scientific reasoning, I'm not thinking science.
Right.
You don't have to be a scientist. I am not a scientist, but I know scientific reasoning. Yeah. I know the scientific method, at least how it works. So basically how to use your brain. And also you need to know how to criticize effectively, not just for the fun of it. And that's why you should read novels. That's why you should read creative work and not just technical stuff or dumb stuff. I mean, it's fine watching John Wick. Just don't watch only John Wick.
Right.
You see my point? You need to watch some deeper stuff or to read some deeper stuff to train your brain to see subtleties and to see that it's not always a big thing over. I mean, the world is full of shades of gray, not all black and white.
Yeah.
And the COVID example is perfect because did the government make many mistakes? Yeah, they did. They did a whole ton of mistakes. They were in the same boat as we are. Were the vaccines perfectly efficient? Probably not. Did they help? Probably yes.
Yeah.
But it was not some big corporation or government trying to manipulate us and to put us into cages or whatever. It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't stand to any argument, but you cannot discuss this because the person in front of you has decided that it is that. And I won't hear it. I won't hear anything else. And they will always be right in their mind.
Right.
So because they won't put themselves into question. When somebody shows proofs to me that I was wrong, okay, I was wrong. You know, it happens. You have to be humble. You don't have a choice. Otherwise, you don't move forward. You stay where you are, just like the orangutan.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you make a good point too about speculative fiction in particular, right? It helps you think about topics and like, you know, this book is not about the 2500s on Earth, right? It's about the 60s and the situation in France and that kind of stuff. And speculative fiction does that. It allows you to look at your current world in light of what this book is presenting. I had a coworker who I would always be talking about a book I was reading, and he told me, no, I never read novels because I feel like if I'm going to read, I should read something nonfiction or something that helps with my career or that kind of stuff. And I just think you learn to think better by exposing yourself to different ideas. And sure, it's great to read nonfiction. I love reading nonfiction, but there's something about novels and especially science fiction novels that challenge you.
It does. Like for example, me, I was trained as a historian. I have a master's in history.
Yeah.
But if I didn't have some level of, if I was not well read, if I had not read so many French novels in my teens and then lots of science fiction work in my 20s and now, I would not have a good understanding of history. I would just be reciting dates. If you do that, if you don't have that capacity of acknowledging differences and subtleties, you read author A and you believe everything he says and you're just going to recite. You're not going to put your brain in between his work and your own way of saying it. Mm-hmm. And then you read author B, oh, okay, he says that, so I'm going to say that now.
Right.
You know, you need your brain and you need your analytical capacity to make your own choice. I mean, in my own podcast, I deliver my vision of what happened, my version. I don't just recite some author. First, that would be plagiarism.
Right.
And of course, it would not just, what's the point, you know?
Yeah.
So am I wrong on certain points? Most probably. Am I going to be challenged? I've been challenged. And it's fine. I should be challenged. I don't have supreme authority on French history.
Yeah.
Not that I'm aware of anyway. But, you know, it is the point is to have a conversation. You're doing this to have a conversation with your listeners, with readers.
Yeah.
I know you are a Hugo Humanited podcast and congratulation on that. Mm-hmm. You're still not a god in science fiction.
Definitely not.
But still, well deserved.
Oh, thank you. I think we're about wrapped on Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, pretty much. It is a great book. I thoroughly recommend it to anybody that has any interest in science fiction or just a good book, honestly. You don't have to enjoy science fiction that much to enjoy that book.
Yeah, it's good stuff. And that's why I wanted to revisit it. And I want to thank you for picking it off the list and for being my first guest in Hugo's There 2.0.
Well, I'm honored, Seth. Merci beaucoup.
Yeah, it's always great to talk to you. So where can people find Lafayette We Are Here?
So you can go on lafayettepodcast.com or you can type Lafayette We Are Here on any podcast platform. And if you ever find yourself in Montreal, Canada, where I am, I work at a camera store called Camtech Photo Leica Boutique. If you want to have a chat, if you enjoy the art of photography, which is my other passion, you're always welcome.
Nice. Perfect. All right, Emmanuel. Wonderful talking to you. I'm sure we'll talk again.
Yes, we will.
Bye, my friend.
Bye.
Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Emmanuel. He's always a great guest. Pleasure to talk to. Make sure you check out his podcast if you're at all interested in French history, which, you know, it's interesting stuff. So I highly recommend it. Thank you for listening to Hugo's There 2.0. I will do another one of these episodes 4 episodes from now on something that I want to cover. In the meantime, I will do a couple of zoomed out episodes and I will do another award winner as well. So I'm not going to tell you what those titles are. The people who I'm going to be recording with already know. So let me know what you thought of this episode and make sure, you know, as always, if you want to support the podcast, you can leave a review any place, post on social media. I did start, in addition to patreon.com/Hugo's podcast, you can, if you want to support on more of a one-off basis, you can go to buymeacoffee.com/SethHeezelD. It's my name. Strike the Y. Put on a D for some reason. I'll make sure to put a link in the show notes to that. So if you want to lob me some money to buy a book, I'd appreciate it. But if not, still, thank you so much for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye.
The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kusky.